Matt Segundo here, and I resent being ejected from the last show for a political candidate. I don't know what the producers were trying to pull here. Did it ever occur to them that I might have a bit of a political view myself? Or that I might vote from time to time? For instance, back in 88, I voted for that funny little man named Dukakis, mainly because he was cute, he was cuddly, and I harbored great fantasies involving his wife, Kitty, in a three-way with Eleanor Roosevelt. If this isn't reason enough to vote, then I suspect your sexual barometer is bland and not nearly as interesting as mine. Anyway, I'm pleased to report that our young roving correspondent got back into the literary game with Alison Bechdel.
Okay, so I am here with Alison Bechdel, author of Fun Home, as well as the long-running strip Dykes to Watch Out For. Alison, how are you doing today?
Pretty good.
Okay. Well, you've subtitled this book, which has received rave reviews, a family tragicomic. Now, I wanted to ask you, aside from the sort of the obvious kind of wordplay, what does the word tragicomic mean to you? Or did this word kind of almost serve as a guide as you were writing the book? Or
I think I approach life in a sort of tragicomic way in mm-hmm. general. Mm-hmm. I think joy and sorrow are inevitably mixed up.
Yeah.
It's a comic book, but it's a sad comic book.
Now, in terms of the tone of this, I mean, this is a very sort of interesting tone you have in the sense that, your father's character is very sort of complex, but you don't actually entirely demonize him. He turns out to be this very sort of interesting figure, and you also play, these dark sort of situations extremely light. So I was wondering if you could maybe sort of talk about how you kind of stumbled upon this tone. And it's almost it reminded me very much actually of Nabokov's Lolita in a certain way. It's like
someone else compared me to Nabokov.
Oh,
I think
really?
That's kind of remarkable. Well, I think I got a lot of this from my father himself. I mean, he was a funeral director. Mm-hmm. That was one of his many jobs. And he was always a little cavalier about it. You know, it was like a thing we joked about. We called the funeral home the fun home. That's where the title of the book comes from. So there was always this odd, this coexisting silliness and death going on in our household. I don't know.
Yeah, that's okay.
Wait, it's a little early in the day. My neurons aren't all firing as well as they might. But let's keep going.
Oh, yeah, no, keep going.
All right. Now I forget what your question was.
Well, the question was specifically like the tone.
The tone
originated, yeah.
Well, yeah. So I grew up with a father who was a mortician. I grew up in a very elaborately restored Gothic Revival house, which added a little bit to the darkness. I grew up obsessed with Charles Addams cartoons. That was a huge formative influence on me. My dad had this book of Charles Addams stuff, and I would read it. I would look at it even before I knew how to read. And I would see these creepy drawings and these inexplicable situations, and I was just fascinated by them. And even when I did learn to read and could make out the captions, they made no sense to me whatsoever, but that just made them more mysterious. And what I would see in these images was my own house, my own family. In a lot of ways, we resembled the Addams family.
The interesting thing, too, is that in the reviews I've read of this book, like, people sort of overlook the kind of funeral home component.
Yeah, it's funny.
Have you noticed that?
Well, there's a lot of components to the book, I'm realizing, and it's hard to hit on them all.
Sure.
Because it's kind of rambling.
Well, I understand that that you sort of initially kind of approached this project basically writing out in a word format what went on, and you hit a stumbling block. At least this is what I understand from a recent discussion you had with Jessica Abel at Ron's site.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, did you experience sort of similar kind of stumbling blocks with the art? Maybe you can describe how the words and the art sort of came together.
It's very hard for me to describe how that happened, because part of what I'm trying to do now that it's all done is trying to reconstruct it. And I sort of, I might have lied a little bit in the Jessica Abel interview, like trying to simplify it.
Yeah.
But really, I didn't have a clear methodology as I began this project. I mean, I've done a comic strip for years.
Yeah.
But this was a totally different thing. I did start by just writing, it's true, just getting down core memories that I sensed instinctively were part of the story. But yeah, I wasn't able to make the kind of, I would hit a dead end with the writing, with, you know, working in a word processing document. Because I'd want to start saying, at the end of any given sentence, I would suddenly have ideas of six directions in which I could go off. And you can't do that in prose. You really pretty much have to follow of one trajectory. I mean, unless you're a much better writer than I am. Mm-hmm. But that's when I started writing in a drawing program, an Illustrator, which enabled me to move my text around on the page to create little blocks of text, create panels, you know, my panel outlines, and essentially to start writing in a visual way, even though I hadn't yet actually done any drawing, but I was starting to think more visually. And when that enabled me to break through that impasse and make, I don't know, segues and associations that I couldn't in prose, but that I could when I added this layer, the strand of images.
Gotcha. Now, at the point when you were working in Illustrator, did you have a lot of sort of the scrapbook ephemera that you sort of described in the introduction of this?
Yes, I was kind of marinating in all that stuff throughout the process. And even though I say I started by writing, really, the real genesis of this book was family photographs. Mm-hmm. At a certain point in my childhood, my dad got out all of these old photos and started organizing them, and I was very interested in them, and I helped him and watched him put them in the albums, and that's something I've always done ever since with my own life. I take a lot of pictures, I organize them.
Yeah.
And I've looked at my own family photos over and over and over and over and over all throughout my childhood, throughout my adulthood. I'm just fascinated by them. And at some point in my young adulthood, I came across this really great book by Michael Leasy called The Meaning of Family Photographs. I think that's the title. And he sort of, he would use found pictures or photos from people he knew or random people he would interview. He'd look at their family photos and he'd psychoanalyze them or analyze them as texts. And he'd find things going on in these photographs. And it was fascinating to me, you know.
This also ties into the distortions of memory that you kind of acknowledge at the very beginning of the book, where you sort of note that these photographs and these various sorts of little annotations in the text are, you know, ways for you to sort of, I guess, not rely so much upon your memory, as opposed you have sort of like objective documents here. Maybe you can describe what some of these photographs actually revealed in a way that your own memories could not.
Well, One particular photograph that I came across in my family photos that my dad had compiled was totally the genesis of the whole book. It was a picture of a young man lying on a hotel room bed in his underwear. And I recognized this guy as a babysitter that my brothers and I had when we were little. And I found this photo about a year after my father died, when I was home just looking through stuff, and it was just stunning to me. I had the whole story about my dad is tied up with my own coming out as a lesbian, you know, shortly before he died and finding out that he was gay. We didn't even get onto that strand yet, did we?
No.
It's very complicated. Yeah, so there's this whole gay thing between me and my dad that I'm trying to sort out in the book. But anyhow, here was this photograph. Like, clearly my father was on intimate terms with this young man. And it just kind of blew my mind. I mean, I knew at that point that he had been gay, but to find this photograph was wild. And it was just a very striking image, you know, kind of like emblazoned itself on my brain. And I just started thinking, you know, there's this whole other reality going that, you know, that was going on in my childhood. And so part of the book is trying to figure out the extent of that other reality.
To some extent, it reminded me very much of like some sort of like one of these kinds of like, you know, how did the murder actually happen? We have the whole like constantly sort of flashbacking to the truck and things like that. I was wondering, were mysteries in some way kind of an influence, or was it really just more of a kind of focus on this particular photograph that was kind of the starting point, the linchpin, the galvanizer?
Yeah, I didn't think of it as a mystery. Someone else asked me that question too. I don't think of it as a mystery. In fact, I give away all the, you know, everything that happens at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. My dad kills himself, or so I think. That's pretty much the only proper dramatic incident in the whole book. The rest is all details. Yeah. But then as I tried to explain the story, it was like a mystery unfolding. Because it's just the gradual revelation of information, and that's what a mystery is.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to manipulate people. I don't like that, you know, keeping people in suspense. I like to tell them everything right out.
But I guess I don't think you're necessarily keeping people in suspense. You're just delving deeper and trying to sort of fit all the strands together here. It seemed, when I was reading this, I was sort of struck by the very sort of structural kind of approach you have. Like, for example, many of the panels you have, you know, you have a lot of maps, you have a lot of sort of like annotations. It was actually, I will confess, rather sort of strangely close to me, because I grew up very obsessed with maps. And so I
really?
kind of saw this whole sort of effort on your part to sort of like create some sort of kind of structure to explain these sorts of ambiguities. And maybe you might want to talk about how you kind of, I want to get back to the one kind of, you know, issue we were talking about in terms of words versus art. Like something like a map of all the sort of places that sort of show everything in a circle. That's a very kind of clear visual representation that will probably, you know, I suppose, progress the story or progress your sort of thinking towards finding this pattern or towards unsolving this mystery. I mean, maybe you can sort of describe how an image like that sort of helped you to, you know, dig up the details here, or to like, you know, come to terms with certain things, or to contextualize.
You know, it's, the maps are funny. The guy who just wrote my review, the review of my book in the New York Times, Sean Woolsey, mm-hmm. actually traveled to my town. He said it's a memoir you can navigate by, and he wanted to like ascertain whether I was really being accurate.
Yeah,
and I was, thank God. Like, he was measuring mileage, you know, that I'd claimed in the book, like that my father lived his life in this 1.5 mile in diameter circle. He was born and died and is buried there. And it's true. But I thought it was funny that he was compelled to actually go to the actual place, and that he could, because I had a map.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm going off the subject here. The thing about maps for me is that I feel like cartooning is very like map making in a way, because it's a way of taking this very complex three-dimensional reality and just ironing it out mm-hmm. into a easily assimilated form, making life readable.
Yeah.
And I also feel like, I don't know.
Well, also, like, you know, something like these maps actually allow for I hesitate to use the word postmodern, but it provides at least a sort of different perspective with which to sort of look upon, you know, a series of events. It's sort of like, you know, your own sort of initial kind of drive to, like, you know, rely predominantly on, you know, the notes that your father wrote in the books or the photographs. These tell the details more so than your memory, or so you say. I mean, maybe you could describe maybe the advantages that drawing upon ephemera has over, you know, dwelling upon your own memory.
Yeah, well, one stunning thing was finding a notation my dad had made in a bird book, like the Peterson's Bird Guide, which I didn't find until years after he died, but there was a little notation that he had spotted a rufous-sided towhee mm-hmm. about 4 days before he died, mm-hmm. which I thought was just fascinating. I mean, if he was unhappy enough to kill himself, what was he doing, like, identifying birds? It seems like really jarring.
Yeah.
But I think also that's very much who my father was, that he could be miserable and also really, really embracing life at the same time in an odd way. I mean, that's obviously, I couldn't remember that. It wasn't part of my own experience. I just happened to run across this in, well, just randomly as I was looking through this book of my dad's.
This project took you, you know, 7 years to write, and again, I hate to keep going back to the question, but this notion of presenting your father as a sort of complex human being, I mean, you know, was there sort of a point when you were writing this where you were demonizing him more than you were sort of like presenting him kind of in a sort of, I guess, you know, more Nabokovian sort of manner, or?
No, I mean, I feel like I've always had very confused feelings about my dad. I mean, partly because I think he was manic depressive, you know, if I can diagnose him posthumously. And it was just always both of these things, really bad and really good. And I couldn't write about him without portraying him in that way. It's very hard for me. I mean, I have a lot of anger at him.
Yeah.
But I also have a lot of love for him. And I don't know, there's just no other way to accurately show him, unless I do both of those things equally.
Is the act of sort of, I guess, emotional catharsis through art, do you feel that by dwelling more upon, like, sort of structure, that it was this your way of kind of finding catharsis, or is there still sort of, you know, stuff here that really kind of didn't make its way into the actual book? Because you mentioned, like, not wanting to hurt people. Did you hold back in any way, or?
I did, you know, I stepped very gingerly around my mother and my brothers. Mm-hmm. And I tried to only include as much of them as was absolutely necessary. Obviously, I had to put in a lot more material about my mom. But I wanted to save my mom for another book, perhaps.
Ah, there you go.
I'm waiting to hear from more distant relatives who might be offended or upset by the book. No one has contacted me yet, but I'm braced for it.
Oh, so you haven't heard from Rob, the babysitter,
no,
or even your old girlfriend Joan or anything?
Actually,
like that?
Joan I was in touch with. I asked her, I ran stuff by her to make sure she was okay with it. I tried to do that I did that with my mother and my brothers as well, like showing them successive drafts of the book just to get their... I didn't want them to all freak out.
I was gonna ask, because I know that this is Houghton Mifflin's first graphic novel that they've actually published.
Yeah.
And I know that you had remarked in another interview that you had sort of experienced editing for the first
time. Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to ask is, like, well, since there's a lot of sort of, you know, dirt that's being dug up here, was there some sort of, like, copious legal clearance process? Or?
Yeah, there was. Yeah. There was a legal reading, and we had to make sure people were okay with things. Yeah. Like Joan, my girlfriend. So far, nothing has arisen.
Well, in terms of, like, getting involved with Houghton Mifflin, how did this come about? What made your particular project be the one that they decided upon?
I don't know.
You don't know?
It's a mystery, but I'm very grateful for it. You know, I feel like I've been toiling away in obscurity for almost 25 years now doing my little subcultural comic strip. Did we mention it? Yeah.
I was going to, but, you know.
I do this comic strip called Dykes to Watch Out For. And I've worked with a lot of small presses, and things were not going well. The press I had been with for a long time changed hands and went bankrupt, and everything got very confusing, and I decided it was time to get an agent, mm-hmm. which I had never done, because who wants to pay an agent a percentage of your already small earnings? So I got an agent, a really good agent, who had very high, you know, set her sights very high for this book, and I was astonished when she sold it to Houghton Mifflin. Mm-hmm. But I'm very pleased about it.
I'm wondering, did you have any particular angle that possibly made this receptive, or did you just have a good agent?
I think she's a good agent, but also, that's what I wanted to say, was I feel like so I've been toiling in obscurity.
Yeah.
Writing this gay and lesbian comic strip, and working in graphic narrative. And both of these things, graphic storytelling and gay and lesbian subject matter, have both been, like, kind of moving toward mainstream acceptance at similar paces over the last, I would say, 20 years. And I feel like I just happened to catch a wave at the right time. You know, not that I wasn't out there, you know, paddling around for a long time with my surfboard, but it feels like a very fortuitous confluence of events.
It's an interesting sort of comparison too. I hadn't thought about that. So
the
development of comics as well as gay and lesbian acceptance.
Yeah.
It's really strange.
It is.
Well, I mean, I wanted to actually also ask you about that particular topic later, but maybe we can talk about Dykes to Watch Out For and how some of the kind of lessons you honed in terms of narrative on that applied possibly to a more all-encompassing work like this. I mean, did you find that now that you're dealing with like this huge project, that it was that you had to adopt new disciplines? Or
Well, certainly having done a comic strip for 20 years with, you know, regular deadlines and really having to crank stuff out was invaluable, because the graphic novel was a Herculean physical feat, I must say.
Yeah.
It was just so much work. I can't even tell you. And I couldn't have just done that out of the blue. I had to have, like, build up my stamina. And so working on a comic strip definitely enabled me to do that. Did that answer your question?
That's sort of
Am I, like, hallucinating? Am I just going off?
No. Hey, you know, if I'm paying attention, I'm listening, we'll get back to it. Just keep on talking,
right.
You know? Oh, well, I mean, you know, I was
done with that.
Okay. Abrupt pause. No, I wanted to ask, though, I mean, like, you said that this was sort of an all-encompassing project. What made Fun Home be the one that sort of, you know, you wanted to kind of basically put your attentions to? Or was this a situation where kind of Fun Home came about just by studying these photos or and whatnot?
Well, I feel like this was a story that I just had to tell. It really felt obligatory. And I felt that for my whole adult life since it happened, since my dad died. It was like, oh my God, this is an incredible story. But I didn't think I could tell it 25 years ago when I was young. I mean, I couldn't reveal this family secret, I didn't think, you know, about my dad's homosexuality or about the suicide, which I didn't think people knew. And also, I was just really young and fucked up, and I had no emotional perspective whatsoever on it. So it took a long time to be able to even think about telling the story. And in that intervening time, I started doing the comic strip. I have trouble, like, with just language. I have all these pictures. I'm going off in all six different directions, and I start to get confused. I wish I could have, like, illustrations as I'm speaking.
Should have brought some paper or something. No, I'm following you, okay, so.
Wait, what were we talking about? I'm sorry.
We were talking about sort of like the launching point. And
oh.
Yeah.
Right. So also 25 years ago, right after my dad died and I was starting to think about telling the story, there was no such thing as a graphic memoir. I mean, Mouse hadn't come out yet.
Yeah.
Comics weren't dealing, for the most part, with serious subject matter or real life at all. And so after doing my comic strip and after seeing this revolution in graphic storytelling, eventually it became clear to me that my story could be a graphic story. And then I started to, you know, slowly wrap my mind around that for a couple of years until finally I had, like, the time and had enough therapy under my belt to sit down and tackle it.
Were there any particular sort of graphic novels or comics that sort of made you kind of say, yes, I can tell my story too? Or
certainly Mouse was a big influence. But also Harvey Pekar's stuff, his American Splendor comics. I discovered those in college, and I was thrilled by those. I still feel like the apotheosis of comics is Harvey's writing and R. Crumb's drawings together.
You had also done some work for Pekar, too.
I did. I was very fortunate to meet Harvey in my youth, back in the 80s. And I illustrated two little pieces for him. Harvey's work was just the fact that he could write about his own everyday life in such, you know, minute detail was thrilling to me. I really just, I love autobiography. I love writing about myself.
Why do you think comics are such a really good forum for these kinds of quotidian details? I mean, you know, it just seems to me that, that the comic form is almost the greatest kind of way to sort of portray life in a sense. I mean, more so, it's more truthful, I suppose, than the memoir. I mean, you know, and I don't mean this in the sort of post-Fry sense, but I mean this in a sort of like, it doesn't feel as schmaltzy sometimes as
well,
the memoir can.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. I'm trying to figure this out. I mean, partly I'm a comic strip artist, or have been for a long time, and the comic strip is like the definition of quotidian. I mean, it comes out every day. You read it on the toilet or having breakfast. It's like, it just weaves itself into your everyday life. And it's about little details of life. It's not about grand sweeping dramas. And so that's something that's always appealed to me about the comic strip form. And also I think graphic stories are able to just show incidental life without having to describe it. It would be boring in a book to read about, you know, I can't even think, just some like totally banal detail, like a piece of crumpled paper on the floor. Mm-hmm. You might not want to waste time describing that. In a picture, you can just show it without drawing attention to it, without pointing to it.
Maybe the sort of taboo against comics is kind of breaking, because comics can sort of show these details visually in a way that I guess people haven't seen before. Or, you know, it's representing perhaps something. I mean, maybe, you know, we were talking about this kind of initially earlier with the maps in your book. But I'm wondering if how much you were sort of, you know, I guess inspired by these quotidian details. I mean, in the sense that, to what degree are you portraying reality from objective artifacts, and to what degree are you portraying it from your own subjective experience?
Well, you know, I feel like I think this is part of what makes me a cartoonist. It's an inability to, like, see the forest for the trees. Like, I see details of things before I see the whole thing. And there's one funny part in the book, funny to me, right after I find out that my father has died, I have to go to my boss at my job, my summer job at school, and tell him that I have to go home. And in the image that I draw, he's on a computer, you know, and this is like 1980, and I draw this old modem that I remember we used it on this job. It's like a telephone receiver, like a handset stuck into like a box. And in this scene where this terrible thing has just happened to me, I make a point of drawing a little box explaining that this is a primitive modem. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like really detached and strange to be noticing this detail at this critical point, but that's the kind of thing that I do.
Yeah, you do quite a lot of that, actually, in this book. You know, little sort of boxes with arrows.
Yeah, well, just things interest me.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, they also allow, again, these sort of points of reference, these visual points of reference that help us to kind of track what's going on and to remember things like the sort of bulky telephone modems, which I, too, remember, you know?
And I guess what I'm trying to say is that might seem extraneous or irrelevant at such a pivotal moment, but to me it's not. It makes that moment more real.
Do you find that you can, because I have this tendency, do you find that, like, for me, I date moments in my life based off of films or books I've read, and I can kind of figure out, okay, this happened when I was reading this, or this happened when I saw this film, and I mean, you know, that's sometimes I think the memory kind of operates along these lines where, you know, you could be recalled by, you know, Madeleine T, or, you know, Proust-wise, or it could be, you know, in our sort of more uncouth times, films or whatever.
Yes.
I mean, maybe, you know, is this the way your kind of brain operates? Maybe you can sort of describe how a modem allows you to sort of unearth the memory.
I think you just did it very well. I don't have anything to add.
Oh, man. I got to stop answering the person's questions. That's the problem.
That was good.
Okay,
very
yes.
eloquent.
You actually, you know, you had slipped me a piece of paper, and I just read right off of that. You were actually speed writing that as I was. Okay. Well, actually, also, though, I mean, the thing that kind of a lot of the marginalia and the sort of artifacts reminded me of, in a weird way, were Ralph Bakshi's rotoscoping in his films. But in a way, though, that you kind of did it in a way that it had a certain kind of personality, whether it was through the box with the arrow.
What's rotoscoping?
Rotoscoping is, have you seen any of, like, Ralph Bakshi's stuff?
I don't know.
He did all these, like, 70s movies.
He did Fritz the Cat.
Like, American Pop and The Lord of the Rings thing. But anyway, he, like, rotoscoping, which was also used in Snow White, is when you have you film a piece of live action, and the animator traces over that. And so it has this kind of, it's been used intermittently, but now it's not so used. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But it has a certain kind of look to it that is both real and not
real.
You know?
That somebody just did a movie like that. That weird, druggy, Be Here Now movie. Did you see that?
Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't, actually. But that's actually, I think you're right. So, but it's been used, it's also used primarily these days for, like, visual effects and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, but, you know, the sense I got with this is that, you know, it was sort of like, it reminded me a little bit of that since it was so closely based off of, you know, things in your scrapbook. But simultaneously, there was, like, a little bit of this personality into it. So what steps did you take to make this not just a sort of, like, you know, facsimile of a photograph or a sort of drawing of a modem, right?
Well, that's interesting because there's two different kinds of drawing in the book. Mm. There are actual photographs that I tried to draw in as photographic a manner as I could. Mm-hmm. I got all caught up in these sort of theoretical questions, like how do I reproduce tone with line, you know? And I eventually just used a very minute kind of cross-hatching for the family photographs to show the tonality.
Yeah.
And I don't do that in the regular story itself. I shade the story itself with ink wash. But then it all started to get mixed up together. Although I still think they have very distinct looks. The photographs look much more realistic. And my drawing itself, I try to make my drawing realistic, but I'm not really a very good drawer. I just work very hard at it, mm-hmm. and it gets pretty realistic, but not as much as a photograph.
Did you find yourself like using more ink wash in Fun Home than through in the Dykes strip? Or?
I don't use the ink wash at all in Dykes. That's completely just pen and ink,
yeah.
Lines and cross hatching. And I use the ink wash in this project mostly to save time because I knew if I cross-hatched it would take the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So this was a little quicker. And also, an interesting and unanticipated side effect was that it gave a kind of, it created a kind of emotional nuance that I really, really like, that just a hard, just black and white wouldn't have done.
Did you find yourself sort of employing more sort of things along these lines? I mean, did you try ink wash before, or were there other sort of experimental kind of things that you were trying?
I did. Uh-huh. I went off on a whole Photoshop tangent at the beginning because I thought Photoshop would be the best way to shade it because I could just do it really quickly. But I learned that, no, it's almost as painstaking as cross-hatching. Plus, you're working on the computer, which is annoying.
Yeah.
But I've always loved ink wash. It's very sensual to me. It's just like I just want to eat the paper that it's on. Black lines combined with ink wash are beautiful to me.
So you're not really a person who works on the computer then. You pretty much need to draw all of your stuff.
I don't draw on the computer. I'll make a lot of corrections on the computer.
Yeah.
But I can't draw on it. I like to have a pen in my hand.
Oh yeah, we were talking about reference. I don't think the book's entirely guided by scrapbook reference because there's also a good deal of pop culture and literature that sort of runs throughout.
Right.
I was wondering if I was kind of suggesting this earlier, but were like books and the paintings that you saw sort of like ways for you to kind of unfurl these memories? I mean, did you find that immersing yourself in culture was the way to sort of focus or go and forward with the structure here? Or?
Well, my dad loved books, and that started creeping more and more into the story. As I wrote it, I found myself like quoting from some of his favorite authors and more and more, and then starting to see themes that were parallel with some of these books. And at a certain point, I realized the books are like, these works of literature are part of my story. And each of the chapters is pretty much built around a different author or book.
We should have gotten you some coffee or something.
I'm sorry.
No, it's totally cool. It's totally cool.
And a thing that I really liked doing, but that started to feel a little crazy, was actually replicating passages of these texts as images in my story. And I spent so much time like copying out, you know, tracing the typesetting in a book, the actual book, like Remembrance of Things Past or Camus. It got a little obsessive, but it felt important to include the actual page with the actual whatever font these things were set in my book. I just love letters and words as images, yeah. You know? So that felt like sort of cheating, like an image shouldn't really be words, but somehow I thought I could do it.
No, but how, I mean, I totally understand because I'm a bit, you know, crazy about typeface myself, but I mean, you know, how something looks is as important as what it says, maybe, you know.
I think so. But then I'm a cartoonist.
Yeah, I know. Then you're a cartoonist. But I mean, you know, even like someone who is verbal, I mean, you know, there is a visual component to text. There is, I mean, also that, you know, I wanted to actually talk about the verbal portion of this book. There's a lot of like, you know, 10-cent words you employ, and
yeah.
I was wondering if this kind of came from dwelling upon literature. I mean, you know, I mean, I didn't mind personally. I was like, hey, great, 10-cent words in comics. This is fantastic. More of this.
I did get a little carried away.
Yeah.
My editor asked me to tone it down, and believe it or not, I did. It was worse before she got her hands on it. I just really love words. I mean, I love the dictionary. There's also a lot of like blown-up dictionary quotations in the book. I feel like, in a way, it was also just words. The story came out of these family photographs, but it also came out of words. In some ways, I wrote the book phoneme by phoneme. I mean, on this very minute level, I was constantly going to the dictionary. I would get ideas for where to go next based on the etymology of the word I had just chosen. It was kind of crazy.
Yeah. Really? Like, what kind of ideas were you getting from a particular sort of, like, word root?
I wish I had the book in front of me. You
book.
Have it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one basic example is at the beginning of chapter 3, where I show the big Webster's page with the word queer on it. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, 100 different meanings of queer, but none of them are the pertinent one for my case.
Yeah.
But that's not really what I'm talking about. Let me see if I can find another. Oh, I don't know. Things like in the story about my father getting stuck in the mud and the milkman finding him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I named the milkman Mort. And there really was a guy named Mort DeHaas in my town. I found it. I had this, like, little history of my town. I don't know if he was the mailman, but he might even have been. But I love that his name was Mort because I liken him to as a milkman in his little white uniform. He seemed to me like a reverse Grim Reaper. And so I like giving him the name Mort because Mort, of course, is death.
Yeah.
Things like that. Like, I mean, who's going to get that? But for me, it was part of the story.
Huh. Well,
that's a little crazy.
But it also kind of, you know, latches on to sort of inspiration. So, I mean, it seems to me that you're as much of a verbal person as you are a sort of visual person. The two kind of cross over.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, an old thing that people say about cartoonists is that they're mediocre writers and mediocre artists.
Yeah. It's exactly what Alex Robinson told me.
Really?
Yeah. He said, like, you know, that's why he became a cartoonist. Like,
well, I think in a way it's true, but what that overlooks is that there's something about writing and drawing together, the fusion of those things, that you can do extremely well while yet being a mediocre writer and a mediocre artist. Putting those things together is a whole different kind of thinking and a whole different kind of writing.
Oh, yeah. I was really curious about this. You mentioned also in the introduction that you were taking reference photos of yourself. And yet, like, constantly throughout this book, we have pictures of you sort of sprawled out on the floor talking on the telephone. So I'm wondering if you actually took reference photos of yourself talking on the telephone or whatnot.
I mean, I did. I'm telling you, I'm a mediocre artist. I needed as much help as I could get. I did. I took reference photos of everything, even simple poses of, like, the back of somebody's head.
Wow.
I'm not sure why. I started to, like, lose a little faith in my own ability to just draw things out of my head. I got very dependent on the camera. But it worked. It's quick. It's pretty quick and easy. It's not like it was a time-consuming thing. And it was fun, too, because... Well, not fun, but it was interesting, because as I was doing these poses, inevitably I was posing as my father, as my mother, and it gave me this sort of curious empathy for them to be, like, looking out at the world as their character.
It's almost Stanislavskian to some degree.
Yeah, it is. You know? Yeah, I'm very much a method cartoonist. Yeah. I did some crazy things, like posing as my dad in his casket, you know, putting on, like, a necktie and a jacket and folding my hands across my chest. That was very odd. Or going to the spot where my dad was killed on the highway and taking pictures. I needed to get reference shots of the area, and I wanted to see what it looked like to have trucks approaching and barreling past. And that was really intense.
So to some degree, it is a bit rotoscoping-like.
Well, it is, I guess. Yeah. But I don't actually trace those images.
Yeah.
I don't trace them. I use the digital camera image just as a reference, and I draw separately. Tracing is, you can always tell when people are tracing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We'll call it Bechdel scoping.
Okay.
What was I going to say? Oh, I wanted to, I don't think I got into this, but, no, I did get into this, but I don't think you actually answered the question, but I wanted to talk about, like, adjusting from this, from Dykes to Fun Home. We kind of got into it a little bit in the sense that it was this all-encompassing work, but, I mean, were there sort of lessons from the strip that kind of helped you to, you know, tackle this large project, or
I have gotten pretty proficient with the basic visual grammar in the comic strip over the years, so I didn't have to start from scratch with that. You know, I have to draw all kinds of things in the strip, so I've gotten pretty good at just tackling difficult images. And I was doing the comic strip at the same time as I was writing the memoir. I'd have, like, 2 weeks to do my comic strips, and then I'd go back to the book, which was kind of good. I don't think I ever would have finished the memoir if I didn't have some, like, obstacle to push against. Yeah.
For you, was it about sort of, I guess, raising the bar in terms of, like, you know, okay, this strip is kind of fulfilling in its own way, but it's only, like, a few panels a week or whatnot, whereas this is something that is more kind of, I guess, did you feel some sort of need to kind of push yourself into some more substantial terrain? Or?
I did. I mean, in a way, this book is, what this book is really about is becoming an artist. Yeah. I feel like it's a, what's that? I just learned this word, a Künstlerroman, a novel about the making of an artist. And that I learned how to be an artist from my father, but my father also really inhibited me from acting as an artist for a long, long time. I became a cartoonist in some ways by default. It was like an art form that my father couldn't see, like those ringtones that teenagers, only teenagers can hear. It was like my dad couldn't register, he didn't have aesthetic criteria for what I was doing, so it was a way to be free of his judgment and his he wanted me to be an artist. He was kind of living vicariously through me in a lot of ways and put a lot of pressure on me to do the things he hadn't done, and it drove me crazy. So I found this safe way to be an artist that I did not consider being an artist. I thought of my cartooning as something, you know, not as not fine art. I was very contemptuous of fine art. It seemed ridiculous to me and decadent. But cartooning was practical and reached people, you know. But this book, doing the memoir, doing Fun Home, I had to, at a certain point, acknowledge that it really was a literary project, that I really needed to do things in it that I hadn't even approached in the comic strip, that I needed, the language is much more stylized and literary, and there's a lot of complicated ideas and references, and it not only is a book about being an artist, I'd like to think that it's actually art.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the thing also, you know, going back to this funeral home thing, I was actually expecting when I was just, like, looking at the reception of this book that there'd be, like, all these references to Six Feet Under, like, you know, about the notion of a funeral home being this total emotional place. And what was interesting is that the LA Times actually had a review from Jill Soloway.
That was very odd. I've actually only seen two episodes of Six Feet Under. I was just destroyed when the show premiered, like, when I was a couple years into this project, and I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe someone is doing this. I just felt terrible. Like, here goes my story.
Oh, really?
Yeah. All I knew was that it was about a funeral home family, but... And I couldn't bring myself to watch it.
And yet, look, this has had a perfectly... okay, reception where people have ignored the funeral home capacity. It's almost as if, I mean, it's almost as if they have sort of, like, denied the actual environment. They comment more upon, like, your father and your coming out, but they don't actually, the interesting thing and the odd thing, and I saw it there in your book, that they don't comment upon the sort of, you know, the actual environment, the actual sort of, like, I think the specifics of the way that, you know, your father restored your home and things like this, you know?
Well,
why? I mean, is this the next kind of stumbling block for comics? I mean, for literary respectability, just come on, like, recognize the artwork too, not just the text.
Maybe. Yeah. Well, it's funny. I did a reading last night, and people had such interesting questions. We would go from what, you know, these probing emotional questions about my relationship with my father to what program did you use to make your digital font? Mm-hmm. And I loved that, because a graphic novel does all those things. You're writing about these very, you know, what's that word? Ed, I'm just
<That's> where's cool. the Kunstler Roman or
no, just, you know, you're writing about very refined ideas, but you're also doing this nitty gritty physical thing, this very primitive thing. Mm-hmm. You've got a nib and ink and paper. Mm-hmm. And your computer. It's like it's abstraction and reality together, physical reality. Mm-hmm. Which I like about it.
But going back to this notion of environment, though, I mean, of environment sort of almost being overlooked. I mean, like, now that I kind of think about this, going back to Maus, it's like people don't recall some of the specifics of, like, what Spiegelman did. I mean, I guess, you know, or can we be content right now knowing that a comic with literary references in it, with 10-cent words, is actually at least being sort of regarded as a literary work? You know, I mean, do you have any thoughts on how comics can even become more literary, more respected, more less sort of trivialized as kind of, you know, cartoonists? I mean, you know, yeah. So,
I think it's happening. I mean, I feel like really pleased about the way people are talking about this book. And I feel like we are almost at the point where people are able to not say, oh, it's cartoons and it's interesting. Not quite, but I think we're getting there. I think I've reached the end of my tether.
Well, in that case, Allison, thank you very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you. No.